They're commanders, we call the shots. From our living room thrones where the action's hot. We're the generals of fiction, the masters of war. In silver screen battles with buttered popcorn. Armchair commanders, armchair commanders.
All right, welcome to the Armchair Commanders podcast. My name is John.
I'm Jack.
And this week, we are fortunate enough to be joined by Brian, who has fortunately saved us from another one of Jack's movie picks. Brian, welcome.
He won't be around to save you every time.
No, he won't.
So Jack had something else in mind. Is that what I'm hearing?
So we have a yearly tradition of...
That you've lost.
Yes, I've lost it every year so far. Where we'll pick an Academy game to bet on. And the winner gets to choose three movies in a row. So last year we bet on the Army-Navy game. This year we decided to go a little outside the box and went with the Coast Guard and Merchant Marine game.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I didn't even know that was a thing until this year. So
I did not know that was a thing until you said it right now.
Yeah, it's called the Secretary's Cup.
That's amazing.
And guess who fucking won?
I'm guessing Jack won.
Yeah.
I'm a Navy football fan. He's an Air Force fan.
Yeah, well, I mean, tough year for Air Force out here.
Which is a shame because they...
It's been brutal the last couple of years. I think it was last season they started out, I think, 8-0.
Yeah, they had a stellar season.
Yeah, and then it's just been downhill from that point forward.
It's got to be a lot harder for you, seeing as you work for them.
You know, I certainly have loyalties to the Air Force Academy, as my employer. I went to a really small military college in South Carolina, called the Citadel, and not obviously known for its football prowess. So that's equally as hard. But I did get my PhD at Kansas State, so I do have a Big 12 team who didn't have a great season. But at least I've got a Big 12 team that I can root for.
Both me and Jack went to the University of South Dakota.
Okay.
USD.
Which their football program is hit or miss a lot of times. So like when they have a good year, it's like, hell yeah. And then other years it's like, eh. But like when we were there at school, like they were just like a notoriously bad, like, when we were there, it was like the first year that they got bumped up to being like a Division I school. And so they're just getting wrecked like week after week. And so the joke was like, it was like a tradition. Like the entire student body would go to the game, but everybody would leave at halftime because that's when the hangover would kick in.
Yeah. Yeah. Those moves into different conferences or especially from D2 to D1 are not always what they're cracked up to be. Right.
But so much more money from advertisers and sponsors.
Yeah. This is neither here nor there and has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But that's like Deion Sanders being the coach of Colorado.
Oh, God.
And I think they finished 3-8. And I mentioned to a buddy of mine, we watch college football together and talk about it all year long. And I said, how long will Colorado keep him there with this record? And they said, and my friend goes, why do they care about the record? Have you seen the money they're bringing in with him?
Right. I mean, plus, does it really matter to him anymore? Like, he got his kid through school, so.
I've got a soft spot in my heart for Deion. I'm from Atlanta. Atlanta Braves fan forever. So I'll always have a soft spot for Neon Deion.
Yes. I just, like, Air Force is the only Colorado team I follow, really, so.
My wife went to Colorado State, so we follow them. And then, like I said, you know, working at the academy and living just down the road from there, you know, so many great opportunities for sporting events about 10 minutes up the road, so.
Yeah. I have my loyalty to Air Force because my dad was a 25-year career guy with them.
That's awesome.
Which you mentioned being Air Force being your employer. Could you tell the fine folks what you do for the Academy?
Yeah, so I am the Air Force Academy Command Historian. That essentially means that I write the annual history for the United States Air Force Academy. Most bases in the Air Force have historians. They're actually attached to a particular unit, not a base, but that's neither here nor there. And so for whatever Air Force organization you work for, you know, you're trying to capture the who, what, when, where, why of what's going on in a particular year. And that looks very different, obviously, at, you know, a fighter squadron, a bomb wing, a maintenance depot, and obviously at a college like I am. But I've been doing the Air Force historian thing for about 15 years now and really enjoy it.
See, Jack, we got an educated person on here.
Ah, Mr. Smart Guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you're so smart, then how come my silverware sparks when I put it in a microwave, huh?
Never cease to amaze me, Jack. So, you know, for being a historian for the Air Force Academy, kind of going into our topic of the evening, Flight of the Intruder, it's a Navy movie. So why the divergence from, you know, the people that cut your paychecks?
Yeah, I just, so obviously the Air Force cuts my paychecks. But outside of the fact that the Air Force pays me, I do a lot of writing and publishing separately. And so I consider myself, an air power historian first. But I've taught courses, not only at the Academy, but other places, and researched and written about basically air power from World War One through present day. So I am not exclusively Air Force focused in my writing. In fact, my most recent book was about a Navy fighter squadron in the Second World War. But really, Flight of the Intruder is just an awesome movie, and it doesn't get enough credit for being as good as it is.
I gotta say, so like I was familiar with, like I had heard of it, but I had never seen it. And you know, when you brought up like, hey, we should do this film, I was like, yeah, like this is as good of a reason as any, because we find ourselves in this kind of conundrum where like we have a list of like 100, 200 films that we're constantly pulling from and adding to. And there are so many films that are on there that are like interesting or would be, you know, it's like, oh yeah, there are movies that are like, yeah, they belong on the list, but you don't know if you would actually ever get around to them.
Yeah.
And this is one of those movies where it's like, just like surface level, like looking at the title and the synopsis, you're like, this is a oddly super specific film. Like,
you know, it's funny. This movie, I mean, there's no doubt this movie was a bomb. Nobody saw this movie. It did not make its money back. And maybe it's, you know, like you said, John, because it's so nuanced. But when you look at it and when you look at why they made it and when they made it, it should have been this big hit.
It definitely should have. What I got from it was like, I'm trying to remember, this was 91.
Comes out in 91.
Okay. So, I mean, like, air epics in Hollywood aren't new by this point, and they had been pretty popular because, you know, you have, like, Battle of Britain and like 12 O'Clock High, all that kind of stuff. So like air power films do well in Hollywood. And like Vietnam is a conflict that Vietnam tends to generate fewer films, but the films it does generate are like almost instantaneous classics, if you will. Because you think about like Platoon or Operation Dumbo Drop. Operation Dumbo Drop, yeah.
That would have been a good one. We should have done Operation Dumbo Drop.
You missed out. We did that like 2 weeks ago.
I'll have to go back and listen to it.
Oh, man, yeah. It was something.
What's your opinion on a airplane doing an airdrop on an elephant?
I don't think, you know, that was made by Disney, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is Dumbo Drop or Operation Dumbo Drop is a Disney property and is a PG-rated Vietnam War film starring Ray Liotta and Dennis Leary.
Yeah, if you guys knew me better, the fact that this is a Vietnam War movie about air power produced by Disney, the fact that I haven't seen it is actually shocking.
Big Disney fan?
Huge Disney fan. In fact, going to Disneyland over Christmas. But
there's getting away from the cold.
There's a very specific Disney tie to air power from the Second World War. And so Disney did this entire movie called Victory Through Air Power, which is basically an hour and a half propaganda film about the importance of strategic bombing. It too was obviously a flop, but it was made during World War II, based off a book. And so on our podcast over at Balloons to Drones, I frequently work Disney and air power into the conversation somehow.
Yeah, so this is a like a specific topic, but also I was like, the feel that I got from this film was like, you know how in World War II air power movies, it's either like the fighter planes, or if it's like a bomber movie, then like the B-17's the star. And it felt like Hollywood is like, you know what? We're going to break into the air war Vietnam market, but we don't really have a star airplane, if you will. So we're going to pick one and we're just going to make it the star.
So what's, if you don't mind, if I kind of talk for a second here. So the movie Flight of the Intruder is based off the book by the same name. The author, Stephen Koontz, was an intruder pilot in Vietnam. But this movie comes directly on the heels of The Hunt for Red October. And so here's how this works. Tom Clancy gets Naval Institute Press to publish his book. Ronald Reagan reads it. It becomes this huge bestseller out of a kind of a small academic press. They make a movie about it. The movie's a huge hit. And then right on the tail of that comes Stephen Koontz. Same thing. Fiction book picked up by Naval Institute Press. Ronald Reagan and Tom Clancy both read it. Becomes a runaway bestseller, huge hit. They make a movie of it. Really, the only difference is that where The Hunt for Red October is kind of considered a classic in the field now, Flight of the Intruder is almost this forgotten film.
Yeah, it's definitely not at the top of the Netflix suggested for you tab.
I'm gonna be honest, I never heard of this movie until now.
So, but do you think you're a better person for it?
No.
Well.
But isn't the fact that it's got Willem Dafoe, like, isn't that alone worth the price of admission?
Oh, absolutely. That's what sold me when I found out he was in it.
I mean, obviously, Danny Glover. I mean, everyone knows Danny Glover. Brad Johnson.
Who was also in Operation Dumbo Drop.
What was that, John?
I said Danny Glover was also in Operation Dumbo Drop. Yeah,
I do recall that. But Brad Johnson, who's kind of the main character here, is, you know, not going to put people in seats in the theater.
No. Willem Dafoe was the big draw.
And he's great. Why? Because he's Willem Dafoe. Like, what is his character in this movie? It's Willem Dafoe in an A6.
I mean, don't forget Tom Sizemore was also in this. So.
He's quintessentially Willem Dafoe in this.
My biggest question about Willem Dafoe in this movie is, why is he the only one that has a tiger stripe flight suit?
I think they did that. Yeah, it's supposed to show that he's been there. He's been around the block. You know, when they introduce his character in the film, he comes in that tiger stripe flight suit with that huge Bowie knife on his gear. And so I think it's supposed to indicate that he's a little different. He's kind of a rough rider, right?
Wild bird.
He's definitely not going to die at the end of this film.
Yeah, man. spoiler alert, John.
Yeah, Christ.
We have a rule around here, which is if a movie is over 25 years old, there's no such thing as spoilers.
There's no such thing as spoiler alerts. Yeah, you've now got me looking at the cast. So obviously, Danny Glover is a big name. Willem Dafoe is a big name. I would guess Rosanna Arquette, and I think Tom Sizemore was probably pretty unknown at this point.
Yeah, because that was before his role in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah, about 8 or 9 years before he did that. I'm trying to remember the actor who plays Ross Geller in Friends, who's also in Band of Brothers.
David Schwimmer. Yeah, I groaned when he was on screen.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's like Second Lieutenant David Schwimmer in this movie. Yeah. I'm guessing it's his first film role. And very forgettable at that.
The one that really stuck out to me was Dan Florek, which you probably can't place him unless you've seen Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I was like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah, he's the doc, right?
Yeah.
Which in what may be the only memorable line for the film, you know, when you talk about, as you guys do, military films, you know, obviously you quote Top Gun all the time. I quote Hunt for Red October all the time. This movie doesn't have a whole lot of one-liners in it. The only one I like is when Doc is getting situated in the A6 and, you know, the pilot says, if we have to, I'll say eject, eject, eject. And Doc says, well, do I say Wilco or Roger? And the pilot says, if you even say, huh, you'll be talking to yourself because I'll be gone.
that was a pretty good line.
Yeah. But beyond that, there's not much in this film that, you would quote to your friends.
What's the movie for tonight? So-and-so. Does it show skin? No, cancel it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as air movies go, John, I think you kind of hit on something that it's not a dogfight movie. It's not a fighter aircraft movie. And it's not really a bomber movie because it's this attack aircraft, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of unfair.
It definitely tried making up for that weird middle ground by having the like Top Gun scenes. Right.
Yeah.
They're like, we got the Navy to back this film. We're going to spend some money on it. You know?
Yeah. I mean, tons of A6 flight time in it. Tons of time spent in the ready room and on the carriers, time spent in Subic Bay on R&R. I mean, it hits all the notes that it should. It just falls incredibly flat. I don't know what kind of barometer it is. I mean, I know that it's 23% on Rotten Tomatoes. It just, to me, it's such a shame. I think it's a good film.
I'm not sure if I would classify it like a good film, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because I think one of the things that really let me down with this, or that fell flat, was, you know, our main character, we start off with him and his co-pilot Bombardier. They're on a mission and it's a super awesome, like, night, like, we're flying in between, like, gunfire, all this. It's awesome. And his co-pilot dies. And so we're 5 minutes into the film and our guy who is flying in Vietnam doing these combat missions, right from the get go, like, everybody kind of treats him like shit, where they're like, yeah, so what? Your partner died. Like, we need to do this debrief, which I'm not saying, like, I could totally see that happening, but our main character is now this, like, stereotypical super anti-Vietnam War conflict character through the entire film. And, like, most great Vietnam War films are anti-war films, anti-Vietnam War. Like, they have that element to it. But the difference is in those other films, like Platoon or Apocalypse Now, you have somebody who's, like, starting from, like, a net neutral spot. And then through the course of the film, as they see terrible things, they become more anti-war, like, eyes open type deal. Versus this, it's like, oh, my buddy died, I'm now anti-war the entire film. There's not really room for progression. Except there is. It goes the opposite way, because two-thirds of the film, he's anti-war, and then he's like, we're going to go bomb Hanoi. And then all of a sudden he's like, fuck yeah, go Navy. And it's like, wait a minute, this isn't how fucking anti-war films work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe your average audience viewer doesn't, you know, there's no nuance in Top Gun, right? Like, Top Gun is what it is. The best of the best of the best of the best. And we're going to train you to be better. And you're going to be this hot shit dogfight pilot. And you're going to go out and kill all the bad guys. You know, Vietnam itself invites a certain amount of nuance. And so maybe the idea that, like, you know, being fed up with the rules of engagement, or being fed up with what you could attack and what you could not attack, and the ambivalence that Drake Grafton feels towards the whole war, maybe that in itself just doesn't sell as a popcorn eating movie.
No, but I would have expected at least the, like, model, like, the tabletop models of SAM missile sites would have drawn in a few extra people.
Yeah. 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 I don't know what it is. To me, it's a good movie. You know, obviously, Paramount bet on it. Naval Institute Press bet on it. And it really is, you know, when you look at the pantheon of, I mean, across genres, military films, Vietnam War films, aerial epics, you know, it hits each one of those and it's forgettable in every one of them. You know, John, like you said, you've got Full Metal Jacket, Hamburger Hill, Platoon. I mean, the list of Vietnam movies goes on and on and on. And this is never going to be on anyone's lips as a Vietnam era film.
You know, I think we should do a top 10 list just to purposely include this and confuse people.
Top 10. I mean, so the question.
Top,
I mean,
10 Vietnam films.
Yeah, top 10.
Flight of the Intruder.
Yeah. I was teaching a class, a grad class on history of air power. And when we got to Vietnam, we did a bracket of every Vietnam movie, and then the students could kind of pick and we'd narrow it down. And I'm 99.9% certain that Flight of the Intruder went out in the first round.
But how far did Operation Dumbo Drop make it?
I don't think Dumbo Drop was on the list. I'm terribly sorry. Although
How could you?
I'm now 100% going to go and watch that because it has to be on Disney Plus, right?
Oh, it is. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm as soon as we hang up tonight, I'm going to go put on Operation Dumbo Drop.
Oh God.
You're welcome in advance.
I love talking shit on Dumbo Drop because I loved that movie as a kid. So like, as a kid, I was like, grew up on a military base. Yeah, like as a kid, it's a dope movie. Like a bunch of army guys are getting into hijinks with an elephant. Awesome.
Like, I mean, if you think of it as a pitch meeting, I've got an idea. A movie about parachuting an elephant out the back of a plane. I'm all in.
I think PETA might have something to say about that nowadays.
Oh, screw him.
Oh my goodness. A little off topic, but on topic. So I don't know if you saw, I think it was Nine News did the article, which for our listeners at home, that's one of the like Denver Metro news outlets. They did an article on a skydiving place out of Boulder, and it's called Mile High Skydiving. And apparently they account for something like 20% of skydiving deaths over the past 5 years.
Christ.
That seems a little out of, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Out of pocket.
It seems the math isn't mathing there.
So I was like, hold on. Cause you know, that's an eye catching title, and in typical news fashion, there's more nuance to that statement than, you know. So Mile High Skydiving, they do somewhere in the order of like six. They're like one of the biggest civilian skydiving places in the U.S. They do in the order of like 60,000 jumps a year, like a ridiculous amount of jumps. So one, the more jumps you do, the more likely you are going to have an accident. It's just a numbers game at that point.
Yeah. I suppose.
Secondly, 10 to 20% of casualties over the past 5 years, that sounds awful. But when you hear that 10 to 20% of casualties from the past 5 years is six people, you're like, oh shit, they did something like almost 300,000 jumps and only six people died? That sounds like a pretty solid safety record to me.
Well, you made me Google it here. And so, you know, when you say 300,000 jumps, six accidents or whatever it is, doesn't sound bad. But your two leading headlines here are Colorado skydiving company linked with seventh death in 7 years.
Okay, so I left one out.
No, it's just seven for seven. Seventh death in 7 years. 60-year-old skydiver plummets to ground, dies after parachute fails to open.
Well, that guy had one foot in the grave anyway. So.
I would hope that in case any of your listeners work at Mile High Skydiving, we can't be held liable for what we're literally reading off of CBS and Nine News.
Hey, I was literally defending them 2 minutes ago. I'm like, if you look at the math, that doesn't sound that bad. I mean, shit, imagine, how many?
I can just imagine many, being at work tomorrow and getting a phone call from Mile High Skydiving.
We're going to sue you.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I'm literally reading headlines off of Google search.
Oh no, not my sponsorship money that I don't get from this podcast.
Exactly.
This is probably a good time to mention, we are not sponsored by Mile High Skydiving.
But we could be.
We could be if you use code Dumbo Drop.
The best Vietnam movie ever made.
If you're looking for a Christmas gift for that special someone on your list.
You know, Jack, I've told you you've needed to come out here for a while. Why don't we go skydiving together?
I'd be down. I just need to do the course they let you, they have to make you go through.
To do like a solo jump? Because I don't think they only make you do like an hour like briefing type deal before they make you do a tandem jump.
Oh, I thought it was like an hours long course you had to do and watch a video and shit.
No.
Fuck, we made me go through an entire course just to scuba dive once.
Mm. I don't know. Maybe we should take Blake up on his offer and go to Oklahoma.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain I am too tall and too fat to do Mile High skydiving.
As am I.
Shit, I'd do it.
We have a buddy who's a regular on this podcast. Have you ever heard of the World War II Airborne Demonstration Team?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So we have a buddy who's on that team, and he's like, yeah, come down to Oklahoma anytime, and we'll put you through jump school. And I'm like, as exciting as that sounds, something tells me my wife would not be stoked on me spending a week in Oklahoma to static line jump out of 100-year-old aircraft.
Yeah, that's going to be a hard no.
But, you know, all the power to him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's going to be a hard no for my wife.
Haven't you ever felt the itch to, like, join the Academy?
With the Earth.
Yeah. Or join the Academy kids when they, because the Academy has, like, a parachuting school, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They have, it looks like it's the same aircraft, the Twin Otter that they use up there at Mile High Skydiving. But yeah, the Academy has had a jump team almost since its creation. They've got like a skydiving team, but they also have like they will put students through the jump school here locally, and they say it's the only course skydiving course where your first jump is solo. You don't do tandem first.
Pretty high pressure right there.
Yeah, I mean, so they've got that. They've got the gliders, and so they've got, you know, any given day I can come into work and there can be parachutes floating down and gliders up in the air and other aircraft flying around. I sometimes forget that's not the normal college experience for most people.
Oh yeah, well, USD had a paleontology course, so there.
Were you a paleontology major?
No. I got my degree in history. That's working out very well for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Fun fact, as you probably know, not a lot of jobs in the history field.
You know, to me it's not that as much as like right now, you know, where are you going to work with a history degree? Where you're going to work for the government, or you're going to work for a museum, you're going to work for, you know, some type of educational facility, be that, you know, undergrad or grad or even, you know, middle school or high school. But if you look at all of the industries that are shrinking right now, it's every one of those.
Yeah, people don't really like spending money on the arts when it's tough times.
Well, I also think that us poor humanities majors, you know, everyone's been beat to death with STEM over the last decade. And this is not my, you know, my jihad against STEM.
Fuck science.
By any stretch of the imagination. It's just that, look, man, we need history majors and English majors too. There has to be a balance.
How are you doing with your library job, Jack?
I'm fine, feeling fine, and looking fine.
Jack, what do you do for the library?
I work for the Accessible Library Services for the state of South Dakota. I copy audiobooks onto cartridges, send them out, receive them. I also edit some audiobooks, mostly local authors. Sometimes I lend my voice. I also do the machine shit. You know, I send out the machines to the patrons so they can listen. It's a great job. Very rewarding.
You sound like you have a radio voice.
Why, thank you.
It's even better when he doesn't use his laptop to record.
I'm not even on my laptop, you dingus. I'm back on my PC.
Oh, so it's just you sounding shitty. Cool.
Fuck you, but yeah.
What was your favorite part of this film, Jack?
Willem Dafoe.
He always does sell his performances.
He's quintessentially Willem Dafoe. And if you've ever, you know, if you've ever watched interviews for me, he talks about how his face can make Willem Dafoe faces. There's a reason, you know, he's probably a part of who knows how many memes at this point.
Oh God.
But
yeah.
He is here to be Willem Dafoe. He's not here to add depth or context to the film, right?
No. He's Willem motherfucking Dafoe, and that's all I want.
Yeah.
How's about we go bomb Hanoi?
So here's my question for you. In this film, they show that like Hanoi is like an off limits zone for like an engagement area. Was that actually the case during Vietnam at any point?
Yep.
Yeah. For most of the war, Hanoi, the port city of Haiphong, and the Chinese border were all three off limits areas, and so there was a 20-mile ring around Hanoi, there was a 10-mile ring around Haiphong, and there was a 5-mile off-limits area across the border with China. Now, you know, in all fairness, this kind of made sense. Obviously, all of North Vietnam's integrated air defense systems, their surface-to-air missiles, their MiG aircraft, those were all coming from China and the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union and China were training them how to use that. And all of that equipment was coming in on Chinese trains and Soviet shipping. So it made sense that there was a very real fear that, you know, an errant bomb in Hanoi or Haiphong might kill Soviet advisors or sink a Soviet ship or blow up a Chinese train. And then this little itty bitty regional proxy war spins out of control
into World War III.
So there were these off limits areas, and between 1964 and 1968, you could not go into those areas. This film takes place, in early 1972, so that there is still an air war going on, but it takes place right before the beginning of the linebacker missions, the linebacker campaigns.
Nixon said, "Fuck Vietnam."
I don't fault. I'm going to be very middle of the road here. I don't fault Johnson for setting up these off limits areas. I mean, you know, in his mind, Korea was only about 15 years before. It made sense to him and his advisors. And of course, by the time Nixon comes along, Nixon gets assurances from the Chinese and the Soviets that they have no interest in widening the war any. So yeah, Nixon is able to take the gloves off because he doesn't have the same fears of reprisal that Johnson has to deal with. So in 1972, when the North Vietnamese invade the South, Nixon makes many targets inside Hanoi and Haiphong, you know, targets that you can strike again or strike for the first time. That's the beauty of them going downtown in the movie is, you know, that they go into this off limits area and wipe out Sam City. And yeah, you're going to get court-martialed for violating the rules of engagement, except oops, that's the exact moment Nixon says, no, go ahead and do that. So, you know,
I love
instead of a court-martial, you're a hero now.
I loved how they literally bombed, like there's a stockpile of missiles in the middle of like a downtown square.
Yeah.
Like one of them blows up and like very Team America World Police, like a missile kind of like follows like a guideline into a window of a building and blows the building up.
Oh, it's like a church, isn't it? Doesn't it go through the window of a church? Or am I
thought it was the hospital?
It was just hilarious. Like, I think that's one of the things that makes this film fall flat is like they have so much help from the Navy. Like, all this amazing footage of the A6s flying around, doing acrobatics, this awesome stuff. Cockpit scenes feel genuine and real. And then all the anti-aircraft fire is this poorly done CGI. And like the SAM missiles are obviously are model kits. Like, it just a weird, like complete opposite ends of the spectrum for the exact same scene.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Navy, you know, who has always been, you know, both the Navy and the Air Force have offices in Hollywood, and they get to pick and choose what films they are willing to collaborate with Hollywood on. Obviously the Navy had this huge recruiting boom with Top Gun in 1985, 1986. And so this is only 4 or 5 years later, right? So, hey, we've done the fighter pilot thing. Let's do the attack pilot thing. It ought to be just as good. And it is not.
I'm going to be a fighter pilot. No, you're going to be a bosun's mate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, a lot of the Air Force and Navy recruiting commercials, you know, that they'll show the latest and greatest, right? The F-18, the F-35, the F-22, whatever it is in the recruiting commercials. But there's a very, very, very narrow line that's going to take you down that particular stovepipe.
I remember I had a good buddy from high school who, it was our senior year, he went to go join the Marine Corps. And this poor guy, he failed the ASVAB 3 times. And so like all throughout senior year, he's like, yeah, I'm going to be a aircraft mechanic for fighter planes. I'm going to be on the aircraft carriers traveling the world. And then 3 failed ASVAB tests later, he was a infantry guy in Okinawa. I'm like, sucks to be you, dude.
Yeah. I didn't know. I never took the ASVAB. It was required in our high school. I skipped that day. So I don't want to begrudge anyone who's ever taken it, but I didn't know it was a thing you could fail. I thought it was more of a spectrum.
The thing is every job has a minimum score.
Yeah, no, there is a basement level that will point you in the direction of certain jobs. There's no doubt about it.
But yeah, I think at the time, like infantry for the Marine Corps was like the lowest ASVAB score, and you needed to get at least like a 20 or 30.
Yeah, I mean there are you know, in all branches of service, everyone has their, if you don't do good on the ASVAB, this is what you're going to end up doing. As I am paid by the United States government, I will not partake in where you end up, because there's exceptions to every rule, right? I mean, there's obviously guys that end up in career fields that go on to do great things. So,
It's all about showing what you got, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one scene that actually, going back to the film, you know, we talk a lot about things that kind of fell flat or didn't really meet expectations. I think one scene in this film that absolutely, like, kind of knocked it out of the park is a scene that most people don't generally care about, and that is the, like, the stereotypical, like, port leave, like, R&R scene where, you know, they're going into the city and go bar hopping and all that. I thought the bar fight scene, fantastic.
Yeah, the time in Subic Bay was yeah, really well done. I mean, just this, you know, typical run-of-the-mill, hole-in-the-wall drinking establishment in the Philippines, where everyone on R&R is going to come together and get up to no end of hijinks.
I will say, though, have you ever watched, like, Bar Rescue from, like, Spike TV?
I have not.
So it's your typical reality TV show where basically these guys go into failing restaurants and bars and, you know, turn them around and all that shit. And in that show, there's one thing that they keep, like, harping on or yelling at people about is those, like, stupid, like, punching bag game machines at bars. And they're always like, there's so much liability associated with this. What if somebody gets hurt? Da, 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 da. And in the bar scene in this movie where they literally have a fucking, like, chair on a pulley system hooked to the ceiling to play this stupid game where people get launched into a mud pit.
Yeah.
I was like, man, the Bar Rescue people would lose their minds about this one.
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that, you know, whatever rules and regulations and liability there was in Subic Bay in 1972, probably not worried about that kind of thing.
So you're saying their insurance rates weren't affected by having a pet alligator?
Yeah, probably no.
This is also something we also talk about, which I think this scene kind of highlights, is a lot of times in our films, Hollywood has a hard time dealing with the topic of racism. And it occurs in this film, like, literally just for, like, if you're scrolling your phone or you blink, you'll miss it. But there's a moment where Danny Glover's character in the bar gets called the N-word. And one of his subordinates, Danny Glover's subordinates, is like, hey, watch your language. And I'm like, what the fuck did I just hear? Like, there's no way this movie just had a character, like, drop the N-word with a hard R and this was the response. But I was like, you know, for 1970s, that actually feels like it kind of tracks.
Yeah, I mean, he, Glover mentions it earlier in the film, right? Where he talks about being a black man with an Italian last name, but he also talks about what it means to be a black man in the United States Navy in 1972, and then you can separate that out into being, you know, he's an officer, he's an attack pilot, all of these different things. And I think if you study Vietnam, you can't really study Vietnam without dealing with race. It plays such a huge role in that conflict.
Right. Because especially, you know, it's a time where the overlap of the civil rights movement is also taking place.
Yeah. And the draft, which is supposed to be this, you know, this egalitarian lottery system that affects everyone equally, does disproportionately affect lower income African Americans. Yeah, I don't have the numbers here in front of me right now, but it is, you know, another example of this is equal, you know, equal across the board. It's not.
Yeah, like 33% of soldiers in Vietnam were black when blacks only took up 11% of the population at the time, give or take.
Yeah.
I do think this film deserves props because it's a very small moment, and like there's a couple of small moments with Danny Glover, but like Hollywood generally doesn't tackle like the racism thing unless it's a film meant to explore that topic.
Yeah, unless it's the Tuskegee Airmen, right?
Right. Or, you know, it's some sort of civil rights adjacent film. Like, this film is supposed to be, you know, Top Gun ripoff, and yet it still is able to sprinkle in these true moments of what the culture was like at the time.
Yeah.
So I will give again, give it props for that.
It does it all, right? I mean, it starts out with this harrowing nighttime bombing mission and getting shot at by SAMs, coming back and debriefing, getting a new bombardier, you know, the R&R and the leave. I mean, it hits everything. It just apparently doesn't hit them very well. Now, listen, if Paramount or Steven Koontz are listening right now, I absolutely adore this movie and this book. I just want to go on the record that this is not me.
Not trying to get sued.
You know, it's not that. I mean, I really do love this movie. I think it deserves better.
I thought this film had a lot of potential. It just happened to fall flat a bunch of places. I was not expecting like I said, the biggest thing that irked me was our main character being like, fuck this war. I don't want to know about the casualty count. Like all these things, the entire movie. And then at the end of the movie, he looks at Danny Glover. He's like, I can't wait to sail under you when you're an admiral.
Yeah. What's the climax of the film? You know, has our intrepid A6 pilots going downtown and somehow still getting shot down in the jungle. But that's neither here nor there, I guess.
Well, it's not a Vietnam movie if you're not duking it down in the jungle.
I don't think, you know, maybe the producers didn't understand that. Look, downtown Hanoi was a major city. Like that was it was not just huts in a jungle. But yeah, they get shot down. Two aircraft get shot down, and then they got to go on the foot chase rescue. And you know, I think this was in the heyday of Siskel and Ebert, like, you know, the final triumphant, you know, getting picked up by the search and rescue was a little over the top. I mean, the crescendo of the music and
or the I was so mad because I was ready because, you know, Danny Glover, he gets to go up into the helicopter first. And the other guy's like, because, you know, there's the climax of like there's a sniper hunting them. And so our main character goes and is like, I'll go draw his fire. And we see like they pan to him and he's dual wielding pistols like it's Call of Duty about to charge this sniper. And then it cuts away. And then, like, a moment later, like, we know he made it and won his battle because he's on the little lift thing, too.
DP?
Yeah.
I might have to leave a bit early, but before I go, what are y'all drinking?
Excellent question. Brian?
Yeah, so this is a big one for me tonight. I'm actually drinking Sassenach Scotch. And as long as we're on the military thing, if you've seen the time traveling science fiction TV show Outlander, this is Sam Heughan's scotch. This actually belongs to my wife, and I was out of scotch tonight, so she was kind enough to let me have some.
Breaking into the spouse's liquor cabinet.
Yeah, I am flat out of that's not true. I'm not flat out. I, you know, my normal drink is Glen Morangy, 10 or 12 years old scotch. I do have some Jack Daniel barrel proof upstairs. Unfortunately, that is 140 proof and not something that I wanted to be doing interviews with while drinking.
I mean, that's your prerogative.
That,
I mean,
man, that stuff will take chrome off a bumper. It is. Do not mess around with it.
It's okay. I made a torpedo juice once for an episode for the Kicks and Giggles, and that was a terrible day.
It's all about balance. So yeah. So I'm a big.
He's educated and classy with his drinks.
The older I get, the more just a scotch in the evening kind of sits right with me. Jack, what about you? I can't see you, so I'm curious.
I'm drinking a Kona Big Wave, some liquid Aloha. Good stuff.
Yeah, excellent.
Very, very on brand for, I don't want to say Pacific War film, but I was like, Vietnam, Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah, John, what about you?
I got to leave you boys for tonight, so have a good one.
Hey, Jack, take care. Nice talking to you.
Love you.
You too, buddy.
I was drinking wine. I'm a cheap date. I was drinking some Stella Rosa because it was left over from Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Yeah. We had driven up to Denver, and per our earlier conversation, I was really in no mood to drink. This is the first drink I've had in a couple days now.
Yeah. So what would you say is your favorite moment from this film?
So I think my favorite moment, the one that I don't know, I get a chuckle out of, I guess, is when they go downtown to do the completely rule violating and illegal bombing of the capital of Hanoi in Sam City. Is they go through, they're on their bomb run. They pickle the bombs. They come out, they see no secondaries. And Willem Dafoe says, you know, he says, Jake Grafton says, what happened? Willem Dafoe looks out and says, you know, the damn bombs didn't drop. And Jake Grafton, our intrepid hero, says, yeah, you gotta be kidding me. And then they go into the, no one would be dumb enough to do that again. And they come back around for the second bomb run. If your bombs don't drop the first time through, that's probably a maintenance and attachment issue. They're probably not going to drop the second time you go through. But for whatever reason, I love the idea that, well, we came here to bomb Hanoi. We're going to bomb Hanoi.
I was going to say, one might call that a clue that you shouldn't be doing it anymore.
Yeah. On several levels. God himself did not want you to drop these bombs.
But then we wouldn't have a cool exploding city scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. John, you're right. It is funny that you've got this support from the Navy. I mean, all of this filming done on the aircraft carriers, and in the ports, and using real footage of A6s, and then what looks like someone lighting M80s for the SAMs, right?
Yeah, it's very jarring, especially because they're like right next to each other. I think that also kind of the thing that I found, I don't know if it's necessarily funny, but like, they put all this effort to show like how intense like anti-aircraft defenses were. And like, we get all this tracer fire and these SAM missiles and like the plane, like every scene, the planes are just turned into Swiss cheese. But like, we only get like two in-air deaths.
Yeah.
One is co-pilot Bombardier Morg at the very beginning of the movie. And it's a random dude with like a Moisés Nagant bolt action rifle who happens to hit this jet flying however many hundreds of miles an hour.
The Golden BB.
Right? So there's one. And then the other one is near the end of the film where the plane literally explodes like it's a TIE fighter in Star Wars.
That is a really weak moment in the film. That is clearly an A6 model that is broken apart.
That it's just not to mention, like, they put a lot of effort into that crashed A6 set. And I think that's one of the other things that makes this film weak, is that there's moments where you're like, I want to see this happen, and then it just cuts away. So, like, we don't see the Ace Danny Glover's A6 crash, but we see it crash the crash site in the jungle.
And it's incredibly detailed.
Yeah, it's an amazing set piece. The same way that, like with our sniper duel scene, like we see our main character run out dual wielding pistols, like, oh, mano y mano. And then, like, we don't see the actual event happen. Yeah, and it's like, this is weird places for you to take shortcuts on.
It's funny to me. And I think this is the way that the public would tend to view it, that look, just because, I mean, obviously if he's an A6 pilot, he's college educated, you know, he's taken some advanced courses. He understands physics. He can fly this aircraft. He's been through years of training, but that doesn't mean that once he's on the ground, he's necessarily a Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
I mean, he goes from A6 intruder pilot to, you know, moving through the jungle, ready to engage the enemy on the ground.
Hey, a warrior is a warrior, right?
I mean, there's a reason that the school you go to is survive, evade is the first one, right? Like, that's, you know, it's survive, evade, resist, and escape. But evade is the first one. Get away from the bad guys.
But that wouldn't make for a climactic movie ending.
It probably would not. This movie, now that I look at it, like, this had, a lot of the people who were involved in Die Hard were involved in this. A lot of the people involved in Hunt for Red October, the music was done by Basil Poldouris, who did the music for Hunt for Red October. It literally comes out the weekend that Operation Desert Storm starts. So maybe folks were glued to their TVs at home watching the real thing, instead of at the theater. This literally comes out the day after the air war starts in Desert Storm.
I mean, I can see that, but I also feel like, you know, there are definitely films that have great success, like, post Iraq and Afghanistan invasion, like, yeah. Black Hawk Down is shortly after the Afghanistan invasion, and that is, like, you know, out of the ballpark popular.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird.
There's no doubt. I mean, you know, nobody
likes
this movie.
I will say, because I hadn't seen the film before, so I watched the original ad for it, the trailer preview, and I was like, oh, this is going to be a painful 2 hours for me. And then when it wasn't, I was pleasantly surprised. But the trailer did not do it any favors either.
I'll have to go back and watch the trailer. But yeah, you know, like you said, I mean, exquisite set pieces, tons of tons of interaction from the Navy. Great, great flight sequences. The interior shots and the way that the pilot is interacting with the bombardier, be it Jake Grafton and Morg, or Jake Grafton and Willem Dafoe's character on the Iron Hand mission. I mean, really fairly accurate stuff, which, you know, John, you're right, is kind of lost when you've got model kits firing up at him.
Yeah. So I think it's about time we put a rating on this. I don't know if you've had a chance to check out many of our other episodes, but we don't do stars around here. We usually pick a thing from the film that we kind of, we either find funny or we think best represents it. So I think today we should do a scale of 1 to 5 bar alligators.
Yeah, I'm going to go with 3 bar alligators.
All right. I think I would also give this a 3 bar alligator. It's a film that's much better than you expect it to be, but it still is disappointing in a lot of ways, but I was definitely entertained by it. So
I think the United States Navy and Paramount thought that they had the next Top Gun or Hunt for Red October on their hands. I think that they really thought they were going to put up an absolute blockbuster of a film, and they did not. And that's just the way it goes sometimes.
It is interesting how that works, especially because we did a review of the film Battleship not too long ago. You know, Hollywood teams up with the Navy to do a film adaptation of a children's game. Great, like CGI scenes and all that. And if you were to look at the track record of like, oh, well, the military teamed up with Hollywood to do Transformers with all these awesome, you know, CGI, you know, combat scenes and all that stuff, Battleship should work too. And it didn't. So it's just,
I don't understand how a movie that stars Rihanna did not do better.
I think it's because they didn't give her enough lines. She had a very flat character in that movie.
Maybe I'm misjudging your audience, but Rihanna, if this is your thing and you're listening to this, thank you for your service. You know, since you brought it up, I want to talk about Transformers for a minute. John, as you know, I spent the last, not the last 2 weeks, but the 6 weeks prior furloughed. And of course, you know, you've got to do something useful, during your furlough time, or you're going to go crazy. So I went back and rewatched every single episode of, 1984 to 1987's Transformers series, one. Which was absolutely magnificent and everything I hoped it would be, and really took me back to my childhood. But Transformers movie by Michael Bay, when that came out and they're in the desert, I don't know if they even say what base they're at, but they're like in the undisclosed location in the desert.
It was just sandy place in Qatar, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But that was actually filmed at Holloman Air Force Base. And forgive me for not knowing the helicopter Transformer's name, the Decepticon. But when he goes on a rampage, he literally steps on my old office. So I was in the theater cheering and very happy to see
him. Yeah, fuck that building.
Crush my office.
I don't think many people have as cathartic a moment that they can lean on like that.
That movie's funny because it's filmed. So it's filmed at Holloman. Those scenes are, which is in Alamogordo, outside of Alamogordo, New Mexico. And it's filmed the year after, I leave there. So it's filmed in 04, 05. And I left in 04. And it was literally filmed like where my office was. So I missed that, but I did get to see him wreck shop on my old base. So that was fun.
Well, it has been great having you.
I appreciate you guys having me.
This is the part of the show where if you have any social media accounts you'd like to share or any projects, I know you mentioned you had a book that you recently were working on, anything you'd like to share with the audience, feel free.
Yeah, sure thing. Fairly active on different socials, so you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Blue Sky. I'm about the only Brian Lastly out there. If you want kind of a link to everything, that's going to be my website, www.brianlastly.com. And look, I have done all manner of Air Force and Air Power books, Navy in World War II, Vietnam Air Power, after Vietnam, Allied Force. I've done a little bit of everything. So you can get links to all of that at my website.
Sounds good. For our listeners at home, if you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. The stars do matter. If you want additional content from us, you can find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, all those good places. Definitely go check out Brian's work. Until next time, I've been John. And Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you all later.